Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to Sunday Civics, the podcast for the civically engaged. I'm your host and civics teacher, Eljoy Williams. And on today's episode, we are going to the boogie down. Jew Moses, you coming with me?
Oh, yes, that's right. I like going up in the Bronx where the people are fresh.
We're going to the boogie down Bronx with the Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. And we're going to learn how a local elected official has dedicated his public career to improving the lives of his neighbors and tackling issues of education, healthcare, income inequality, poverty, and the economic revitalization of the Bronx. That's the borough president. We'll talk about what the role of a borough president is for those of you who don't have one. We'll talk about what they're responsible for. But June, like the month, and Moses, like the Bible, is here with us. Hey, June.
Hey, Eljoy Williams, political strategist.
Now, let me ask you something. So you grew up in...
I grew up in Elmsford, New York, which is just it's about 30 miles up. It's in Westchester County.
Okay. So I, you know, primarily, I rep Brooklyn now, but I grew up in Rosedale, Queens. And I'm going to tell you, I wasn't allowed to go uptown when I couldn't go uptown by myself when I was younger.
So like I would steal my dad's car, right?
Oh,
and we would get in the car, right? And the first thing we would do was drive and stay in our lane and go to Act Tree in the Bronx because that's where you went. And we sprayed up our hair like Dibby Dibby girls. We wanted to go and rub some paint off the walls because that's what you did. Yes.
Yeah, no, I could go to the furthest I could go by myself was West 4th.
Oh, you weren't allowed to.
So I could go to Bill. I couldn't go up. So I couldn't go to Harlem by myself, and I definitely couldn't go to Bronx. Don't you let me see. Somebody said that you was up in the Bronx.
Oh, so, yeah, you would get things taken.
Rosedale, for those of you who know anything about New York City and the boroughs and, like, you know, the reputation of, like, you know, Rosedale and, like, Queens girls.
Or coming
versus
from Westchester.
You know, and all. It's a whole thing that we won't get into because it has nothing to do with civic engagement.
Not at all.
Civic engagement. But just a quick, some housekeeping things. You are listening to Sunday Civics here on Sirius XM Urban View Channel 126. We're here every Sunday at 10 a.m. You can listen on demand on Sirius XM. You can also go to our website at sundaycivics.org. You can subscribe, see the past show, see videos of our guests. And then we have lots of resources there, June, right?
Always. You better, if you don't know how to vote or you need a friend who needs to vote, we got a tool for that. You want to figure out something on a blog because democracy is a learned behavior. There's a spot for that. There's a spot for everything. Come get civically engaged.
Yes. And we just introduced Civic Book Club, where we're putting up, I'm curating suggestions of books where you can dive a little deeper. Remember, you need to understand the history and context of certain issues. If you're going to work on these issues, particularly if you're going to run for office, I don't need you to be on, some debate and somebody asks you something about housing and you don't know nothing about it.
How about not stopping people in the street who are running and asking them crazy questions off the wall because you have no context about what you're talking about? You're just talking crazy.
I'm just saying.
Context matters, people.
Just go to
the website. Thank you, Eljoy.
Sign up for Civic Book Club. We have our first guest. We're talking about housing, segregation, and particularly the government's hand in housing segregation and discrimination.
This book.
With the book, The Color of Law, the history of racial segregation in this country. And then we have a live talk back with the author, Richard Rothstein, on April 4th. So you're going to want to participate in that conversation. We'll air it here afterwards, but, you know.
If you're going to participate, you got to be a civic patron.
Yes, you definitely. So go make sure to visit that. So let's take a trip to the Bronx. Are you ready?
Always ready for the Bronx.
Yes. So I have with me here, as I introduce, Ruben Diaz Jr. He's the entered public office as a member of the New York State Assembly in 1997. I was in college. He's currently serving his third full term as Bronx Borough President, having been reelected in 2017. He's led a robust agenda of economic development, housing, health and wellness, whole revitalization in the Bronx. We're going to talk more about that. And before he was borough president, he was in the state legislature. That's where I met him. And during that time, he earned a reputation as a champion for working families in the Bronx and across New York State. He is a lifelong resident of the Bronx. Welcome to the show, Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr.
Right. It's good to be here. First of all, let me just congratulate you, Eljoy, for all of your accomplishments. You know, I used to see you a lot on the national media, and here you are taking this globally. We appreciate everything that you've accomplished and how you and, of course, June are educating the public. I'm proud of you. You're a strong Black sister doing it big. And for me, this is the first time that I come on your show. I'm just so happy to be here. And so we can get right to it, but I'm really proud of you.
Eldra is very dope.
This is dope, yeah.
Well, you know, so those of you who actually go to the website and see the show notes for this episode, so anything that we talk about in the show, any issues or articles we're discussing, we're going to put in the show notes for this episode. And if you go there, you'll get to see a special picture of me and Borough President Ruben Diaz with the throwback hip-hop pose out in the streets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And one time we were like the 30 under 30 or 40
yeah,
under
yeah,
40.
Yeah, we were right. Was it City and State?
City
I think.
And State?
Yeah, we were like, you know, the top to watch or something like that.
And now look at you. You're like doing what you're doing. Look, he's doing what he do.
We're all grown ups now.
We all grown up.
I'm getting a tan over here. There's so much light. It's so much light. Let me put on my shades. Oh, my God.
So thank you very much for coming to the studio
here
and having a conversation with us. So, you know, one of the things we talk about on the show, I think it's the power of storytelling is really important. Mm-hmm. And because it helps to let people know that there are other people who have experienced what you may have experienced. It lets people know, hear different stories of engagement. Mm-hmm. You know, we say on the show, there is not one way to be civically engaged. Civic engagement doesn't begin on and end on election day. There are many different paths to civic engagement. So I talked about you being borough president. You were in the state legislature. But let's go all the way back. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear the story of your first civic action.
Well, the first civic action that I can remember, and I want to go through a couple of them, because I come from a family that has always instilled that in myself and in my siblings. My sister is a retired police sergeant for the NYPD. My brother's still a supervisor for the New York City Housing Authority. But my first civic engagement was when my dad ran for the state senate back in 1980. I was 7 years old. And I remember being involved in that campaign, licking envelopes. You can't do this now, but there was like, I don't know what you call it. There was this glue that they look almost like oatmeal. That you would go up and down and you would put up posters. And we used to have so much fun, not necessarily putting up the posters, but having glue fights, knocking on doors. I was 7 years old, telling folks, vote for my dad. He didn't win that race. Uh-huh. But I remember that very clearly. And that was my introduction to politics. Also, the family, we had a number of different community centers and senior citizen programs. So very early on, we always went either on Easter, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Thanksgiving. We would always serve the seniors at the senior center, Casa Boricua, on 172nd Street, 910 East 172nd Street and Southern Boulevard. And we would serve the seniors. I remember also delivering Meals on Wheels lunches.
Wow.
I was just telling the story not so long ago. If any of your listeners have ever read a book called The Wild Cowboys, this was about, you know, the crack epidemic and how drugs were pervasive. They still are, but the way it was back in the 70s and the 80s, particularly in areas like the South Bronx, there was this this area called Diego Beekman Houses, and the Wild Cowboys, they control that area around St. Mary's Park. I remember having to deliver Meals on Wheels lunches on that block while the Wild Cowboys were out there during that period of time. I was 13, 14, 15 years of age during the summer months. So, and I would volunteer through my father's programs. So this wasn't like summer youth job.
Right.
My father would give us a stipend. He wasn't too generous. but for me, that was the very beginnings of understanding that, at least from my mom, who was a retired daycare teacher, and my father, who started with these programs, who is now currently in the New York City Council, served in the state senate. But this was the beginnings of them instilling in my brother, sister, and I, I'm the baby of three, that no matter what we do in life, we all have a responsibility to do for our community. And while my sister went on to the NYPD, my brother went on to the New York City Housing Authority, where he's a supervisor now, I decided that at the tender age of 21, that there wasn't enough representation for young people in my community and in the Bronx. So I ran against a 23-year incumbent for what's called a district leader position, is a party position, and I won. I didn't think I was going to win. I remember getting the fellas to help me out, buying them pizza and
the food of campaigns, yeah, is pizza and donuts, and
we didn't have a campaign headquarters. We didn't even have a real campaign going on. It was just the fellas going out. We were young, and they would go to the housing developments with me and stuff the doors with copies of my name. And we wind up getting about 72% of the vote.
Wow.
Which started to prepare me for running for the assembly at the age of 22, when there was a vacancy. And this is 22 years ago now. And I lost that special election February 15th.
You still remember the day?
Oh, yes. 1996. I received 23% of the vote. But that didn't get me down. I continued to work harder. I knew I was going to run again during the primaries. I knocked on 10,014 doors.
Wow.
And as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah. And then, you know, later, that's how I met you when I was working at City Hall. Mm-hmm. Was work for the speaker. And, you know, even before that, in working in advocacy, working with Demos, the think tank. And now everybody's talking about same day registration and, you know, early voting and everything. But we were talking about it at a time where it was, you know, still foreign to a lot of states. And I remember meeting you during that time. We were talking about engaging young people in the political process and some of the things that were necessary in those early conversations, sort of talking about that. And I remember being, you know, just really struck that everyone always talked about you being young and sort of, you know, being elected so young. Why do you think it's so hard for young people to sort of, you know, make that decision and be in elected office that, you know, in that early age, in the early 20s?
I think it's twofold. There's two sides to the coin. I know, and we're seeing this more and more often, especially look what we saw a couple of weeks ago in Washington, D.C. and throughout the nation. We were able to send 5 buses of young folks. Young people are finding their voices at earlier ages. They're articulate, they're passionate, they're smart, they're thoughtful, and they want to see something done. And I think that that's always been the case. However, young folks, at least in my generation, did not necessarily feel like the adults were interested or wanted to be helpful. And the other side of that coin is that they were right, that there were very few adults who took or take young people seriously. It's not only in the political arena. You see that in families. You see that in the neighborhoods where seldom do you see adults confident enough and compassionate enough to take a pause and speak to young folks, but also be an active and good listener. So for me at the time, I was frustrated with that. And I was able to get in. And I think over the last 22 years, whether it being in the assembly or being the borough president, working with the other Democrats, I'm a Democrat, working with other folks in the Bronx organization, we've done a pretty good job at cultivating and nurturing that young, talented leadership. And we have a pool of individuals in the Bronx, from Marcos Crespo, who started as my intern, who's now the county chairman and chair of Somos el Futuro, to Richie Torres, who is now the chair of the city council. Richie's not even 30 yet. And he's like, he just turned 30. And he's the chair of the city council's committee on investigation, oversight and investigation. Rafael Salamanca, Vanessa Gibson, Latoya Joyner. These are young, dynamic, Michael Blake. We have great fantastic elected officials now. And I'm happy that not only was I able to succeed, but also I stayed true to something that was very important to me, which is to cultivate young leadership and know and understand when to get out the way and let them, you know, run with a project or run with an issue. And it's working. And I think and I hope that it becomes contagious, because with social media, with all of the things that we're seeing, and we'll dive into a lot of them, whether it's the lack of resources of education, housing, displacement, health issues. We need young people now more than ever. I don't have to convince you of this, but when you look at the civil rights movement, I mean, the young men and women who all went down to D.C. to protest for the March for Our Lives, they went down there in the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King. They went down in those buses in the spirit of the Freedom Riders. They went down there in the spirit of Rosa Parks. And while we read about all of these giants, the masses in all of these movements, and even globally, have always been young people. And for me, I have to admit that when I was the 20-something-year-old in politics, there were times where I was discouraged. I felt that this giant was just asleep. And now, with this generation of young folks, I'm happy to see that the giant has awakened.
Wow. Well, we'll dive in more and talk about some of the issues you mentioned when we come back from this break. I want to talk about some of the issues that you've had to tackle, particularly as borough president. And I promise we're going to explain what borough president is when we come right back. Welcome back to Sunday Civics, the show for the civically engaged. I am your host, L. Joy Williams. I got my Thurwitz girl with me, June, like the month, Moses, like the Bible.
Morning, L. Joy Williams, political strategist.
I fight for what's right.
Be it day or night.
And also continuing with us is the Bronx Borough President here in New York City. You know, let's start here. Because borough president is unique in New York City. Mm-hmm. Let's start by giving the folks in education, because we have listeners from all over, and explaining what the position of borough president is, because it's not common across the country. So explain to folks what that position is.
So take a step back a little bit. The folks need to know that the city of New York has 5 boroughs. They're also counties. In the state of New York, you have 62 counties. But in the city, we call our counties boroughs as well. So you have the mayor of the city of New York, and you have the city council. And just like the state and federal government, the mayor is the executive branch, the council is the legislative branch. They work together. And then you have, because once upon a time, before the city council had the authority to negotiate a budget with the mayor, you had something called the Board of Estimates. And the Board of Estimate was comprised of the mayor and his appointment, the city comptroller, as well as the 5 borough presidents. Every borough has a president. And our position is unique in that we're the only officials in the city of New York, 5 of us, who represent the entire borough. So the mayor represents the entire city. The city council members represent their districts. You have other state legislators, and they represent, obviously, their district. But we're the ones who have to look at the borough in its entirety, with all of its complexities and all of the population. So in the Bronx, we have 1.4 million residents.
Yeah, that's it. And with 44 square miles. So that's like larger than, that population is larger than, I think, 11 states.
11 states.
Yeah, 11 right. states.
So the borough president, which was granted a much more influential position under the Board of Estimates, but we're still very influential in that we appoint all of the community board members. So in the Bronx, we have 12 community boards, 50 members each board. We appoint those members with consultation of the city council members. Mm-hmm. We appoint someone to the panel for educational policy, which is what used to be known as the Board of Education, but it's changed. And so now we appoint folks there. We have appointments to the pension board, to the franchise concession, board. So whether it's, you know, the
cable companies
and they want to do communications. We have a say in the ULURP process, which is the public process for land use and rezoning. We also divvy up among the five of us, it's formula-based, some capital. It's called RESOA money. That's capital money. Depending on the size of the borough and the population of the borough, that formula gives us each an allotment so that we can allocate that money for everything from new housing to parks to schools to a number of different institutions or recreational facilities. And it's to the tune of tens of millions of dollars every single year.
You know, so I can go down the geek rabbit hole, June, because I know the whole history of the, you know, abolishment of the Board of Estimate. It was based upon a Supreme Court case. Wonderful. And Koch was like mayor at the time and black folks was challenging him and he got mad. And it was like this, you know.
During the 70s, everybody was challenging Koch. He and everybody was taking over hospitals. He was shutting everything down. It was a different time. It was just a different time.
So it's actually based upon a Supreme Court case. And it was argued, guess who was still on the bench then when the case was argued?
Thurgood Marshall. It's a different
and
court
I got
now.
To be so how I learned about petitioning in New York City is being on the floor. This is a quick story. So I was on the floor in this attorney's office, early days of my political career, learning how to clean petition signatures for people to get on a ballot. And so it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. Right, like you're trying to bind petitions together.
The most important thing,
right?
Your listeners and your viewers should know that is the most important thing in politics. But go ahead.
Yes, right. So it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. It's like old pizza. Like you're sitting around and you're just trying to, you know, you're cleaning up petition signatures to bind them to take them to Board of Elections. That's open now until a certain, you know, tomorrow gonna be open for a certain time. And so you need some kind of entertainment. And so the older attorneys start telling stories. Yeah, I don't know nothing about this. You know how old folks do you.
Right.
They start telling you don't know nothing
about. I find myself
about
doing that now.
You don't know nothing about position, right? And so one of them starts to say, to tell you the time that I argued a case in front of Thurgood Marshall. And so you could literally, this like story could like fit in Coming to America too, because we were like, you ain't never argued no case in front of Thurgood Marshall.
The barbershop scene.
You said like, no, you didn't. Right, he's like, you know, yeah, and so he tells us a story and, like, you know, what was happening on the ground. And it like, resulted also in the expansion of the city council.
Right.
The reason why that we have the number of council members that we have.
51.
And it was based upon, you know, the Supreme Court case that was argued, because there was, at the time, the borough presidents on the Board of Estimate, they had one vote, right? And said, how can you possibly
one vote
when different boroughs, particularly Brooklyn, has many more people than Staten Island, right? And so, you know, one day I'll have that attorney on, and maybe all of them that sort of had that that were able to argue that case, and you know, because I'm a nerd and I know these things.
So just follow it. Let's piggyback off of that for 1 second. Maybe what they should have done as a compromise, right? Like the Great Compromise, where so in the state of New York you have a bicameral legislature,
right?
In the federal government you do the same, right? You have the House of Reps and you have the U.S. Senate. In Albany, you have the assembly members and the state senators. What they should have done is that the borough president should have been like the equivalent of the Senate.
Ah.
Right? And therefore, so this way, right? Because that was the same argument that you had when the founding fathers were crafting the Constitution, where some states were bigger than others, and then the smaller states were saying, well, wait a minute, they're going to have more sway.
Right.
If we just go with House of Representatives and we just do it by population base, we should have some equity here.
So are you arguing for a charter?
I don't know. I'm just saying
See,
that.
I'm just saying
that's what they should have did.
I always argue this, like, you know, for those of you who don't have borough presidents, because I don't think anybody else has borough presidents.
Are borough presidents like aldermen?
No,
the city council members.
Because, you know, as he pointed out, that they also, because our boroughs are also counties, so they're more liking to county executives than they are to aldermen or to city council persons, right? Because they represent a larger area. But even in that place, they don't have as much power as county executives do in other.
So, June, for instance, we don't have control over the police department.
No.
Like a county executive does. We don't have control over a budget, an operating budget for the county. We don't have we work with the Bronx Chief of Police, but they are appointed by the commissioner, who's appointed by the mayor. We work with the all of the heads of parks and sanitation and so on and so forth of our boroughs, but we don't get to appoint them. And we certainly don't have that overall budget to operate the borough.
Yeah. And that's particularly important because even when we talk about law enforcement reform, so, you know, I have a whole, we'll do, you know, we've done one show already about law enforcement reform. We can do many more because we ask law enforcement to do way too much and they should be broken up. Because, you know, sometimes you don't need a person with a gun to show up to address certain issues. So that's a whole nother show. We can go from there. But I agree with you in terms of what else can we do in terms of breaking up, political power in New York City. People think of New York City as just because they're comparing it to cities they may have in their states and other things. And, you know, we're larger. Our budgets are larger than some states, right? The amount of people that we're governing are larger. And so when you go across the country, a lot of you have representatives, state representatives and council representatives that represent much smaller amounts of people than, say, New York City does. And so when you're talking about greater representation, greater voice and say-so in how your community is governed, I think it's appalling that only one person, you know, this being the form of mayor, that the commissioner of policing, this huge, the largest police force in the, you know, in the country, there's only one person responsible, the commissioner is responsible for. Right. So those are things, I guess, as we grow as a society, as we grow as a governing, you know, society and people are getting engaged more and more, that we probably have to look about changing some of the structures.
Some of that is coming down the pipe with charter revision commissions again. Again, in 1989, the charter commission was changed. The charter is essentially the constitution of the city of New York. So we have the state constitution, we have the constitution of the United States, and the charter is sort of the constitution of the city. And every so often, there's a new commission that's formed either by the mayor or the city council. In this case, we have competing commissions that are being proposed. But then whatever changes that they put forth that they would like to see in the Constitution or additions, addendums or expansion of powers, or then goes before the voting public. And so maybe these are some of the things in the near future that will be addressed.
So let me ask you this question. So you mentioned there are 1.4 million people in the Bronx, right? That is representative of a lot of different diverse communities, right? So it's not a homogenous community by far. And so what do you have to do and what do you tell your staff to do to make sure that all of the voices and communities that reside in the Bronx are represented and heard?
So again, what you try to do as best you can is to have a staff that's representative of the population. So I have an extreme diverse staff. Just going, just so that the viewers know and the listeners know, out of the 1.4 million people who call the Bronx home, 41% were born in another country. The Bronx that people are accustomed to hearing about is much different today than the negative stereotypes and the images of yesteryear. About 37-38% of the people who live in the Bronx did not live in the Bronx or were not born 25 years ago.
Wow.
So it's a new population, and we are one of the few, I think, if not the only county of the 62 counties in the state of New York, where the majority of the population are both female and Latino. With that said, we have a huge West African population. And so one of the things that we did to reach out once we saw the how robust and how involved they were getting. We have a Bronx Borough President African Advisory Council that meets in my office every single month. Mm. We also have a huge Bangladeshi community, 100,000 plus Mexicans. We have Albanians. We already have the first elected Albanian in the history of the state in Mark Jonai. That's how big the Albanian community is in the Bronx. So we reach out to folks either by having task force, whether it's the African Advisory Task Force, Veterans Task Force we had out of the office, the Bronx Youth Corps for the youth. The community boards are our eyes and ears. That's the ground zero of civic engagement. So people come to the community boards every single month, the police precinct councils, which we always have staff. We have we get a high volume of constituents in our constituent office. So, and it's always putting out information, doing Heritage Month celebrations. So once upon a time, you just did like, the Irish Month celebration of Puerto Rican. Now you have to do, there's some months where you do three and four.
Wow.
So we do a lot of that.
Mm. And so you mentioned that.
I wish I could learn all of the languages.
I know.
We speak to them.
That would be dope. That would be very
but
nice.
But I'm still working on English and Spanish.
I'm working, so I'm married. My husband's family is from Puerto Rico. And so my mother-in-law is insistent that her grandchildren will know Spanish. She said she has this whole story of how she tried to teach my husband Spanish. And because he rebuffed her when he was four, like her petty decision was, well, I'm just not going to teach Spanish. And I was like, and so I say to my husband now, I was like, that was your fault. Because why are you being petty to your mama at 4 years old and now you can't speak Spanish?
It's interesting. What is that logic? Oh, God.
It's interesting, but because on that note, like, we come from a family and a community where in the 70s, we were not necessarily encouraged to speak Spanish.
Hmm. Even though
Papi and Mami are from Puerto Rico, Mami's from Ponce, Papi's from Bayamón, we were taught learn English.
Mm-hmm. Not just English, proper English.
Proper English. We want you to make sure that you don't have a heavy accent, mm-hmm. even though we have a New York and a Bronx accent.
Right.
But my parents just didn't want my brother, sister, and I to have the same accent that they had.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we were... a household where mom and dad would speak to us in Spanish. So I always understood I could read, write in Spanish, but I was always hesitant to speak it. And it wasn't until I became an assembly member. There's a story here. George Pataki was the governor of the state of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's not Latino. But when he would come to the South Bronx or come to the, to events, he would speak fluent Spanish. And if you are the assembly member, the way it works, you have the governor, you're like the host assembly member or state senator. Here you have the governor here who's not Latino before a majority Latino crowd, and he speaks Spanish. And then you go up to say a few words, and
it's all in English.
My Spanish was nowhere near as good as his.
Wow.
So I had to go back. And at the same time, simultaneously, I was a student at Lehman College.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about that if you like as well. But so I'm a part-time student at Lehman College. I'm a young assembly member. I'm a father. So I decided to take some Spanish courses, and then I started reading out loud and in Spanish on my own, El Diario, and instead of just reading it silently, I would read it out loud so I could start being able to express and enunciate in the governmental vernacular all of the issues. So for instance, we would chop words up. And if taxes in Spanish, a Puerto Rican from New York would say los taxes. And that's not even a word. So it wasn't until I started really getting entrenched and reading it that then now you say impuestos, right? So things like that.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is, so from high school, I took 4 years of Spanish. And then, all of my friends growing up were Jamaican, Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Pakistani, right? And so I could understand. What's really funny is, and Haitian, as we go to college, what's really funny is I can understand women, like Puerto Rican women, Haitian women, like I can understand, I think it's the speed in which they speak that I can understand exactly what they're saying. Mm-hmm. I can't speak it back to them.
Oh no.
But I can understand exactly, you know, what they're saying. And so now, like, my husband and I said, well, okay, we're gonna learn because our kids are not gonna be able to cuss us out in Spanish because they learned.
And then look
Spanish.
At now how the Latino population is growing. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. It's grown exponentially.
Yeah. So you talked about the negative stereotypes that people may have had of the Bronx in the past about poverty, about violence. Part of the reason why I wasn't allowed to go up was this, you know, stereotype of you're going to get beat down if you go to the Bronx, right, when we were teenagers. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the many assets and potential of the Bronx, because you mentioned some of the demographics that have changed since then. Let's talk about that, because, you know, similar to what some other towns and states and like Midwest towns and rural areas are experiencing in terms of needing job development and economic revitalization, they can learn some things about what you're doing in the Bronx. Let's talk about that.
So what people should understand is that in the last 8 years alone, in my first two terms, the Bronx has seen a turnaround. We've seen the reduction in crime to the tune of, well, it's the safest Bronx that the world has seen since 1951. I don't know how to celebrate this because I'm going to speak about the homicide rate now. Mm-hmm. The homicide last year in the Bronx was 72 for the entire borough. When I was a teenager, let's take 1990, I was 17 years old, there were 653 homicides in the Bronx.
Wow.
And you take a particular precinct, like say the 48th precinct, had north of 100 homicides in 1 year. Last year was our fourth consecutive year with under 100 for the entire borough. So we're nowhere near as dangerous. And if you look at the national metric where you compare different communities and cities, we're safer. If you take the one homicide for every 100,000 residents, we're safer than Houston, Dallas, Boston. We're safer than D.C. We're safer than Philly. You don't even have to go to Detroit and Chicago. No disrespect to any other, you know, right. but that's just not where we are. And yet people still think that we're the Bronx of the 70s and the 80s. Mm-hmm. In the last 8 years alone, we've seen $15.5 billion private dollars invested in the borough. 68 million square feet of economic development. 30,000 plus units of housing, all kind of housing from very low income to high area medium income so that we can retain our working professionals to home ownership. We have seen tourism increase by 14%. So people are starting to realize that you can come to the Bronx and we're more than just coming to Yankee Stadium or the Bronx Zoo or the Botanical Garden. We have the Bronx Children's Museum, the Museum of Arts. We have so many different restaurants and our nightlife is bustling, right? So we've seen unemployment. When I first took office, Eljoy, the unemployment rate was 14.1%. And our last numbers, we were at about 6%.
Wow.
So we've cut unemployment by more than half. We've gone as low as 5.5. In other words, and it's not just, I mean, there's probably some economists listening to us and say, oh, that's just people get off the rolls. No, no. 110,000 more Bronxites are working today than the first day that I took office. Mm. So you have all of this economic development. You have our largest employer, which is the healthcare industry. Obviously, tourism is helping a whole lot. Retail, we have the first indoor mall that we were able to open up three and a half years ago in the Bronx. Instead of us going to other malls, now we have an indoor mall in Bay Plaza. We are sprucing up Orchard Beach. But we also have the tech industry who's coming there. Mm-hmm. Film industry, we have the Silver Cup Studios open up 115,000 square foot studio in the Port Morris section of the Bronx. York Studios is doing 330,000 square units in Soundview. We have microbreweries from the Port Morris Distillery to the Gun Hill Brewery, Chelsea Brewery, the Bronx Brewery. So there's so many different economies now and industries that are coming to our borough. And we just hope that people take another look at us. A lot of folks left us and never came back. So come and rediscover the Bronx. And if you never have come to us, come in and see us for the first time. You can just go to simplyilovethebronx.com and you'll get all of the information on restaurants and activities and places to see. And I'm working on a hip-hop museum, too.
I I heard about that. Well, June, maybe we have to take a trip up to the Bronx for our soapbox tour. I'm throwing a soapbox on a corner and teaching people civics over the summer. So maybe we'll go up to the Bronx and see how many people know the three branches of... Can I tell you how sad this was? I watched some new game show, and this woman had an opportunity to win $1 million. The question she had, June, this was on Ellen's new like game show or whatever. The question was, what are the three branches of government? And she couldn't answer.
You know what? I am not going to fault that woman because...
For $1 million?
Listen, I took the ride in the cash cab. And when you see how I lost in the cash cab, you're going to be like, hold on. Is she sitting up on a civic show? Yes, because they disorientate you and everything. It's not as easy as it looks on TV. So everybody on game shows look like a boob. But it's a different thing. Lady, I appreciate you because I understand. I know everybody think you don't know, but I understand you, lady.
I want to be a teacher one day. And
is that your retirement plan too? Absolutely. It's my retirement plan.
Absolutely.
It's to teach? Like children?
Yes.
No, well, not for kids. You know I don't do. Okay. I can't do teenagers.
All right, because I was like, wait.
Yeah, I can't do
that
teenagers.
Don't sound like retirement?
although my husband always says, so my husband is a high school teacher. So he's good with high school students. He doesn't like middle school students. He was like, they are terrorists.
Tough crowd.
He was like, don't do middle school. I can do middle school. So we have a deal with our children that I will take 10 to 14 and then he will take 14 to 18.
You know what? You need to get that
rating. What I do is I take advantage of this position. Just today I was in a school, shout out to PS106.
Oh.
So I like to teach state government and local politics.
Ah.
And even though I am of a particular political persuasion, I try to be, objective. I am objective. I don't try to just sell my point of view. And the kids have a good time, and we start off with the three branches of government. And ultimately, I end up splitting the classes. And I do this at every grade level. I've done this from third graders all the way up to the high schoolers. And obviously, the conversations are a little different depending on the ages. But ultimately, and this is a great exercise, you split the class and you make one side the New York State Assembly. And you take another group and you make them the state senate. And they get to see how even when there's a good idea, which we say it's a bill, right?
Right.
That you want to introduce, how it's very difficult to get the majority of both houses on board, let alone get the governor to sign on to it.
Wow.
Which would normally be the teacher or the principal.
Yeah, we have to come in. We have to do that exercise at some point. We're going to conventions and stuff over the summer. We'll probably have to do some miniaturized versions of that and get more young people. And people request me all the time. I'm going and teaching 5 people, 10 people, and 200 people about civic education and ways to be civically engaged. When we come back, I have one final question for our bro president. For those of you, we have a lot of people who are running for office who listen to the show. And so I want to get his suggestion to those of you who are running for the first time for local offices in your community, what advice he gives you for stepping out on faith. We'll be right back.
All right. Standing by the speaker, but suddenly I had this. Fever wasn't me or either, but some of madness. Cause I just can't stand around, so I get closer, and the closer I get, the better it sounds. My mind start to activate, rhymes collaborate. So when I heard this beat, I just had to make sound from the top of my head. So I fell into the grooves of the wax, and I said, how can I move the crowd? First of all, ain't no mistakes allowed. Here's the introduction, put it together. It's simple, ain't it? But quite clever. Some of you been trying to write rhymes for years, but weak ideas irritate my ears. Is this the best that you can make? Cause if not, if you got more, I'll wait. But don't make me wait too long, cause I'ma move on the dance floor when they put something smooth on. So turn up the bass, it's better when it's loud, cause I like to move the crowd.
Oh!
Yeah.
That was not me. That was Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. showing culture.
That was Rakim.
Your culture.
Rakim is one of my top 5.
Oh, he's one of your... Okay, now, since you said the top 5, now you got to tell us what the top... Your top 5
is. My top 5 are KRS-One,
okay,
Rakim, Biggie, Big Pun, and Eminem. That's okay. A solid five.
And you split a Bronx one up in there.
Two of them. Big Pun and
KRS-One. Yeah.
Okay, that's right.
Lyrically speaking, I mean, my favorite rapper is Fat Joe. That's my brother. Okay. Shout out to Fat Joe. But lyrically speaking, those are my top five.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right, that's a respectable five.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You can't, you know, you can debate, you can, you know, debate over, you know, Uno or Spades about that, but, you know.
Not over Spades. Someone could get hurt. Oh. Hip hop and Spades. What are you doing, Eljoy? We need people to get out and vote, kill one another.
I know. Wait, did you see, a friend of ours on Twitter, Naima, she had the R&B bracket.
Oh, my God.
Yo.
It got bloody in them streets.
Listen, in my text messages, my mama was like... cussing me out about like different picks. She was like, hell no, you're not about to pick In Vogue over. I was like, oh, mama. Craziness. All right. So, June, you had a question just before we get wrap this up.
Yes, because this has been absolutely wonderful. I'm having a ball, but I got a question for you, dear Bronx Borough President Diaz Jr. Now, I'm your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And because I'm over in Harlem, and right over across from me is like 138th Street, and it's really coming up very nice. But a lot of my friends across on the other side of the bridge there are upset about gentrification and feel like they're being pushed out in favor of these microbreweries and all these other fun, beautiful, lovely things. But they don't feel like there's a place for them, and they don't feel like they can afford that space anymore. So how do you address them? And how do you make them feel comfortable? Because I'm experiencing the same thing, and it's a losing battle.
Gentrification and displacement is real in the city of New York, and it weighs on me every single day. And we always have to find a way to make sure that people can afford to stay. Number one, we have to create jobs the way we've done in the Bronx. Number two, we have to make sure that they have good salaries. That's the reason why we supported the increase in the minimum wage and living wage. That the living wage law of the city of New York started out with the battle that we had with the Kingsbridge Armory when I first got into office, and the Bronx. We started that battle, and we want people to have decent wages. We also want to make sure that folks don't get harassed by their landlords. So we are the ones who started a pilot program with a certificate of no harassment to make sure that landlords can prove that they have a good record with their tenants if they want the right or the permits in order to enhance their property. On the 138th Street side, over the bridge, for those who don't know, that's Mott Haven and Port Morris.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a split, which is the Major Deegan.
Mm-hmm.
On one side of the split, on the west side of the split, you have Mitchell Houses, you have Millbrook Houses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on 138th Street, you have Patterson, Mott Haven. No one is going to force anyone out of NYCHA. Where we see the development of the microbrewery, that's the industrial part.
Mm-hmm.
That is the part that goes towards Hunts Point, where there were prostitutes and hookers and drug dealing many, many years ago when I was a teenager. Nobody wanted to be there. It was desolate. There was nothing going on. So what we did is we took that area, and what we've been inviting folks to do development, housing. And yes, it could be a little more expensive, but we're not forcing anybody out. Why, June? Because no one lived there to begin with. Number two, we know in the Bronx, and by the way, when you speak of the Bronx and how it was burned down in the 70s and the 80s, the one thing that they did to us is that they beat us down spiritually and psychologically so bad that, number one, people ran away, and number two, the people who stayed started to feel like we didn't deserve any better. So what we try to do, psychologically speaking, in the Bronx is say there is a community. There's a working class citizenry. There's a professional skilled working class. My son is 25 years old, graduated from BC, making six figures. Where does he go? So we've been doing a lot of low income, deep affordability, and we'll continue to do that. But we also saw that there has to be a carve out because many of our young, talented professionals did not qualify because they made so much money.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the development that's happening, and by the way, when we talk of breweries and brick oven pizza, there's a lot of folks in the Bronx who also want that and who deserve that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get to the point now that if we're speaking of the connector, which is the bridge between the Bronx and Randall's Island, oh, that has to be for a community. When we speak of investing in our public parks, and we've done that to the tune of $350 million since I've been the borough president, oh, that must be for somebody else. If there is a new coffee shop, that must be for somebody else. No, We in the Bronx have been shortchanged for so long. We make sure that developers hire Bronxites, that they hire Bronx vendors. We continue to fight for better salaries. We continue to fight for more jobs. People want to stay now because it's safer, and people want the amenities. So we've learned what's worked in other boroughs, and we've also learned from other boroughs what has not worked so well. So while folks may want to say gentrification and things like that, in that particular area, no one has been forced out. Are there new things coming up? Yes, but that's also for Bronxites.
Okay. Well, this has been a lovely conversation, and certainly we can go like another hour.
I certainly could.
We're going to have another show. I think we need to have a panel conversation on gentrification, partly because I don't think people have a clear understanding of what gentrification is, right? Because you talk to some people and they believe gentrification is white people moving on my block.
And that's
right,
wrong.
People may think gentrification is Starbucks opening up on, you know, like, so right. People have this wide variety of what gentrification is. And I just, when we went up to Albany for NAACP Lobby Day, Charles Barron was talking about, the clear definition of what that is. So we have a few minutes to wrap up here, sir. Mm-hmm. I want you to give advice to, I know for a fact there is a few of folks who are running for public office for the first time for local level. You talked about running for state committee as a district leader. I'm sorry. We have people that are running for a state committeeman in their district. They're running for, state office for the first time. As we close up here, what advice would you give someone running for the first time, either for those hyper-local positions that may not be paid to running for city council or state office?
So is the question geared to just those who are candidates or just getting involved in?
To the candidates, because we're having a lot of you guys write in for advice. So I wanted to have you speak to that.
So obviously, depending on what position, you have to raise the money, but I think that nothing beats more. The best part is to get out there, knock on doors, and to be organized and to give it all that you have so that the day after the election, I lost my first election, as I stated earlier, for the New York State Assembly on that special election. I had a lot of regrets. I felt like I should have done this more and done that more. When I said that I knocked on those 10,000 doors, whether I had won or lost that race, which thank God I won, I knew one thing for certain, that the following day, there was going to be no regrets. Mm. So when you go out there, give it the best that you have, knock on doors, listen, be an active listener. Sometimes we think that we want to run for office so that people can hear us speak. And what people really want is for somebody to listen and to be an advocate for their concerns.
Thank you very much to Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. for joining us as we took this trip to the Bronx.
Thank you.
You know, we're going to come out and, you know, I go to the Bronx now that I'm an adult and my grandma can't tell me where I can't go. Because I'm now the boss of her.
And the Bronx loves you and welcomes you.
Right.
You too, June.
So thank you guys very much for listening. Enjoy your Sunday. Remember to go to sundaycivics.org. You can actually catch that video of Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. rapping on our website at sundaycivics.org. Mm-hmm. Thank you guys for listening. We'll be back next Sunday here on SiriusXM Urban View, Channel 126. Thanks for listening to Sunday Civics. Visit our website at www.sundaycivics.org, where you can watch the full interviews of our guests, subscribe and download previous episodes, and much more. While you're there, be sure to check out our resources page for more information and tools on how to take civic action in your community. Join us next Sunday for another episode of Sunday Civics. Now go get civically engaged.